A swell of violins punctuated by a thunderclap. No moviegoer in the mid-1930s could have misinterpreted the message. Calamity was at hand. But then, just about every audience member seeing this black and white talkie in theaters would have known what was about to happen anyway. Maria Martin, played with wide, ever-innocent eyes by Sophie Stewart, stands beside a wooden fence in the English countryside. Under normal circumstances, Martin would have sought shelter at the first sign of foul weather, but tonight she is waiting for her fiancé, the wealthy squire William Corder. The couple have plans to elope to London. Played by Master of the Macabre Todd Slaughter, the first actor ever to portray Sweeney Todd on screen, Corder emerges from the darkness, wrapped in a great cloak and carrying a lantern. "The storm is too fierce," he declares on arrival. "The trip to London will have to wait. For now, they must take cover." "But where can we go?" Martin asks, her voice heavy with disappointment about the delay. Corder fixes his eyes on a structure off-screen. "The Red Barn," he answers. The camera cuts to reveal the single-story, thatched-roof edifice that the country gentleman is looking at, initially coal black and then bone white amid a flash of lightning. Corder leads Martin into the barn, its floor made of dirt and strewn with hay. The building stands empty, but for a few rakes and other agricultural implements leaning against the wall. The two are alone as Corder locks the exit. "Why do you bar the door?" Martin asks, not unlike Little Red Riding Hood puzzling over her grandmother's oversized incisors. "To keep the others out and you in, my beauty," he responds. A belated sense that something is wrong descends on Martin, and Corder drops the act. He has no intention of taking her hand in marriage. "Didn't I make you a promise, Maria?" the squire demands, his eyes aglow with lupine malice. And then Todd Slaughter delivers the kind of line he was born to deliver. "I promised to make you a bride." "Don't be afraid, Maria. You shall be a bride. A bride of death." This sequence comes from Maria Martin or The Red Barn Murder, a 1935 film melodrama directed by Milton Rosner. Unless you're a historical true crime aficionado, and you admittedly might be if you're listening to this podcast, there's a good chance you've never heard of the Red Barn Murder. Yet just over 60 years before Jack the Ripper stalked the streets of Whitechapel in 1888, it seemed a contender for crime of the century. Committed in 1827, the Red Barn Murder sparked a cultural phenomenon, spawning countless books, plays, newspaper columns, ballads, and more. In the words of Pauline Chapman, the lamentable fate of Maria Martin became, quote, almost folkloric, unquote, part of the narrative atmosphere that Britons grew up breathing. As the Todd Slaughter film adaptation indicates, it still hung in the air more than a century after the murder. That's partly thanks to Madame Tussaud. The Red Barn Murder caused such a sensation and brought such a windfall for those who exploited it that Tussaud wanted in on the action. Profiting on this homicide represented a turning point in the wax modeler's career, changing the kind of criminals that she would depict. Today, we'll hear how Tussaud fought for and won her artistic independence from her exploitative business partner, how she established a name for herself in Scotland and Ireland, and how she took advantage of a killing that captivated the public like few others had in the 19th century. This is The Art of Crime, and I'm your host, Gavin Whitehead. Welcome to Episode 5 of Queen of Crime, The Red Barn Murder. When we last left off with Madame Tussaud, she had partnered with phantasmagoria performer Paul Philippstahl and taken her show to London. Whereas her elder son Joseph came along for the ride, she had no choice but to bid farewell to her husband Francois and her younger boy Francis. Tussaud had accepted tough terms when she signed on with Philippstahl. He demanded 50% of her earnings while also expecting her to pay her own travel expenses. Even so, she could not have intuited the hidden depths of his unscrupulousness. Not only did he refuse to promote her exhibition with the same determination as he marketed his own, but he also relegated her to the basement of their home base, the Lyceum Theater. takings were low and so were Tussaud's spirits for the first few months. Like her mentor, Philippe Curtius, however, Tussaud had her finger on the pulse of public opinion, and when Colonel Edward Marcus Despard went to the gallows for high treason in February 1803, she perceived an opportunity to profit on the interest his case had aroused. After she fashioned an effigy of the convicted traitor, business took off. Just as Tussaud was getting her bearings, however, Philip Stahl informed her of his unilateral decision to leave London for Edinburgh. He had unfinished business in the British capital, he added, so she would have to make the sea voyage around the eastern coast of England on her own. Ever the cheapskate, he expected her to foot the bill for her transportation, even as he foisted this obligation on her with virtually zero notice. After months of mistreatment, Tussaud had had enough. A small body of her correspondence with various French contacts, including her husband, has miraculously survived the ravages of time. In one of these letters, she relates that she came within a hair's breadth of breaking with Philip Stahl over this issue. Quote, "I threatened to return to Paris, and when he saw I meant business, he gave me £10. One has to be wary of Philip Stahl," unquote. Philip Stahl plainly had not anticipated such defiance, and this dispute should have convinced him that he also needed to be wary of her. The date of Tussaud's departure was slated for April 27, 1803. She dreaded what awaited her in Edinburgh. On April 25th, she wrote to François in loopy script that slopes across the page, freely mingling French and German phrases. For a moment, her tone is one of profound frustration with a lack of support from both Philip Stahl and François. Quote, "Philip Stahl treats me as you do. He has left me all alone. It is better so, as he is angry about everything," unquote. Yet François' flaws are soon forgotten, at least within the context of this letter. With precious few friends in London and unable to speak more than a few basic sentences in English, the intensely isolated Marie and Joseph were homesick. Referring to Joseph by his nickname, Tussaud declares, quote, "Nini and I cried with joy and sadness at not being able to embrace you," unquote. She expects more of the same loneliness in Scotland, promising to share her new address in Edinburgh as soon as she can so that he can write. Quote, "I implore you, my love, to reply at once, as your letters are the only consolation in a place where I know no one. I will end by embracing you 1,000 times, unquote. On April 27th, having carefully boxed up her precious cargo of waxen likenesses, Tussaud and Joseph went to the wharves and set sail for Scotland. The journey hardly augured well. So choppy were the waters that even seasoned seafarers succumbed to mal de mer. Ferocious waves crested and splashed onto the vessel, forcing Tussaud to spend most of the trip below deck. Quote, "The boat rolled in the most terrifying manner," she wrote home, and the captain, who had made this voyage 100 times, said he had never seen anything like it, unquote. Tussaud's seasickness was at least tempered by motherly pride. Despite the violent push and pull of the tide, quote, "Monsieur Nini was not afraid. He made friends with the captain and everyone else. In fact, the captain wished he had a child like him," unquote. 5-year-old Joseph's indomitable courage even earned him the nickname Little Bonaparte. Tussaud was still queasy when she landed in Edinburgh on May 10th. She wrote to François, quote, "with a bad head, as if I was on board," unquote. But lingering nausea was the least of her worries. Freshly arrived in yet another strange city, she found herself in desperate need of money. Philip Stahl had given her £10 for the journey, but the total came to £18. She was unable to make up the difference. To her horror, moreover, the turbulent transit had damaged her waxen displays, which had sustained no fewer than 36 breakages. Repairs were imperative, and that would set her back even further. The solution to Tussaud's predicament came in the form of fellow Francophone and family friend Monsieur Henri-Louis Charles. Monsieur Charles was a traveling ventriloquist by trade and hailed from the same tight-knit community of showmen and women who made their livings on the Boulevard du Temple in Paris. He had arrived in Edinburgh about a month before Tussaud. She certainly knew him beforehand, and it's possible that her surrogate father and mentor, Philippe Curtius, had even employed him at his wax salon. Maybe the most endearingly grandiose entertainer we've encountered this season, Monsieur Charles was no ordinary ventriloquist. He did his show without a single dummy. He dubbed his performance the auricular, that is, auditory communications of the invisible girl. An advertisement in the Edinburgh Evening Current billed the exhibition as, quote, the only true original and the most incomprehensible experiment that has ever been witnessed in the world, unquote. There was some truth to this hyperbolic advertising. Based on what I've read, Monsieur Charles' trickery was incomprehensible. He supplied the voice of the invisible girl, an all-seeing entity who remained unseen. Throughout, customers could ask the invisible girl questions in English, French, or German, and she would respond in the same language. Though nowhere in sight, she appeared to know what audience members were doing at every moment. In short, one contemporary witness enthused, everything is as completely visible to her as she is invisible to the assembly, near whom she seems to sigh close to their ears, so that her breath may not only be heard, but also felt. She follows all their notions and seems even to guess their thoughts, unquote. Also part of the spectacle was an intricate metalwork apparatus mounted on stage, with a tube attached to it. If patrons lifted the device to their ears, the invisible girl could seem to speak through it. Monsieur Charles was a godsend for Tussaud. When he learned of her money troubles, he made her a loan of £30, which sufficed to cover her debts. He even offered to stay on in Edinburgh to ensure that she got her show up and running before he left town. Next to Philip Stahl, Monsieur Charles was a paragon of generosity. Thanking her benefactor, Tussaud went looking for a suitable exhibition venue. Within 2 days, she had located one at Bernard's Rooms, Thistle Street, which she describes as, quote, a nice salon, well-furnished and decorated for £2 a month, unquote. She and Joseph would lodge at the same address. Around this time, Tussaud also hired an interpreter fluent in French, German, and English. This helper assisted her in placing advertisements and writing copy for museum catalogs, facilitating the adjustment to her new surroundings. She opened for business on May 18th, 8 days after her arrival in Edinburgh. Admission was 2 shillings, and the hours of operation lasted from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and then from 6 to 8. The schedule could be grueling. Sometimes Tussaud and Joseph were too exhausted even to cook dinner for themselves. To the wax modeler's delight, however, her collection met with immediate success. Over the course of the first 8 days, she wrote to Francois, daily earnings had climbed from £3, 14 shillings on opening day to £13, 6 shillings on the last, making for a total of 133 visitors. Profits ballooned even more in the following 2 weeks, yielding an impressive £190. Everyone is astonished by my figures, Tussaud declares in a letter to Francois dated May 26th, the equal of which no one has seen here. She was never one to humble brag. It was not just skill that accounted for the healthy turnout. It was also the topicality of Tussaud's collection. As we discussed last time, Tussaud was able to travel from Paris to London thanks to the Treaty of Amiens, which ended hostilities between England and France. On May 17, 1803, however, just 1 day before she opened her doors to the public in Edinburgh, the fragile truce fractured, with England declaring war on France. The revived conflict would rage for 12 years. The war endowed Tussaud's waxworks about the French Revolution, as well as current events in France, with a sense of urgency. Sensing as much, Tussaud placed advertisements promoting, quote, accurate models of life from Bonaparte, first consul of the French Republic, unquote, along with other effigies of French notables. Tussaud may have claimed a certain objectivity in her waxwork. She represented her subjects exactly as they appeared in life, she insisted, but she by no means took a neutral stance in catalog entries about them. As we mentioned earlier this season, Tussaud's customers could purchase catalogs at the door for an additional fee, and these guidebooks included brief write-ups about the cultural, historical, and political significance of the figures depicted. The earliest surviving example dates from her time in Scotland, bearing the unwieldy title of Biographical Sketches of the Characters Composing the Cabinet of Composite Figures Executed by the Celebrated Curtius of Paris and His Successors. Tussaud is hardly a dispassionate observer regarding the rise of Napoleon. Quote, For whether the ruler be called a monarch or a consul, the catalog reads, it is of little consequence to the people if their liberties must be sacrificed for his aggrandizement, unquote. Nor does she mince words about the threat he posed to the United Kingdom. He intends to, quote, overthrow her people, their laws, and their liberties, unquote. These sentiments would have played well, since her customers were likely to share these concerns. Not only was Tussaud doing a brisk business in Edinburgh, but she and Joseph were enjoying a more robust social life than they had in London. A favorite hangout was Edinburgh Castle, the colossal hilltop fortification that dates back to the Middle Ages. She calls Edinburgh, quote, a beautiful little city from which one can see snow-covered mountains, unquote, and she may have had the sweeping castle vista in mind when writing that remark. It was at Edinburgh Castle that she became acquainted with an unnamed lady-in-waiting who had spent time in France where she attained fluency in French. Tussaud would have cherished every opportunity to reminisce about home in her mother tongue, and she and this friend of hers appear to have done so on more than one occasion. Joseph also formed a close friendship. Quote, Monsieur Nini is dressed like a prince and spends all day at the castle with a little French boy, unquote. In the warm glow of companionship and profit, the stifling isolation and hardship of London faded into a distant memory. Unfortunately for Tussaud, Philip Stahl was as much a snake as ever. He slithered into town shortly after she first unveiled her artwork. He should have been pleased with her warm reception. He was entitled to half of the earnings, after all. But Philip Stahl was endlessly greedy, easily threatened, and equally prone to petty jealousy, so he was less than thrilled. Quote, Philip Stahl is worrying about my success, Tussaud wrote home, and wondering how to get more money out of me, unquote. In more desperate terms, she added in a later letter, quote, he holds my nose to the grindstone, seeking only to flout and ruin me so he can take all, unquote. Philip Stahl's disastrous Edinburgh debut only compounded the problem. In addition to his signature spookfest, he was exhibiting mechanized automata. According to an advertisement in the Edinburgh Evening Current, one of the contraptions represented a 6-foot Spanish rope dancer, quote, that seems almost endowed with human faculties. The power of respiration which the mechanism here demonstrates is incredible, unquote. The same machine appeared to smoke a pipe and, quote, marks the time of the music with a small whistle, unquote. On Philip Stahl's first night in Edinburgh, this automaton smoked, whistled, and danced to marvelous effect. But the phantasmagoria ran off the rails when a series of technical glitches rendered it more farcical than frightening. The fiasco so thoroughly embarrassed Philip Stahl that he apologized in the Edinburgh Evening Current, admitting that his magic lantern, quote, was not completely in order and failed of producing the effect intended, unquote. He never recovered from the misstep, and on July 23rd, he surprised Tussaud with yet another carte blanche decision. She was to close her exhibit straight away. It was time to move on from enchanted Edinburgh. Tussaud was livid. In a letter to a certain Madame Allemand, Tussaud strikes a defiant tone, quote, I have good friends, and if he thinks I am afraid of him, he is mistaken. She goes on, I am regarded as a great lady here and have everyone on my side, unquote. Tussaud took her grievances to the lawyers, to little avail. The only lawful means of ending her subjugation, she ascertained, was to buy her way out. The citizens of Edinburgh had heaped plenty of money into her purse, but she still could not afford to pay the scoundrel off. Between May 18th and July 23rd, she had brought in £420. She had set her heart on an uptick in ticket sales in July, during which Edinburgh hosted a horse fair, but the well-attended event had not given her the bump she hoped for. Her expenses totaled £118, which, subtracted from £420, left her with £302. From that sum, she owed Philip Stahl a hefty £150.16. Strictly speaking, she had the funds, but she clearly worried about getting by on what she would have left over. She had no alternative but to bide her time. Tussaud finally purchased her artistic liberty in early 1804. By that time, Philip Stahl had dragged her first to Glasgow and then to Dublin. Sadly, we have no specifics about when she closed the deal, but she may have savored the schadenfreude of knowing that she was flying free while he was nosediving into debt and insignificance. His box office was abysmal, and in May 1804, his financial situation grew so dire that he put his magic lantern apparatus up for sale. According to a newspaper advertisement, quote, "Any gentleman of a scientific and mechanical turn will find this an object worth his attention, either for gratification of private society or, in its present successful connection, with the public as a source of profit," unquote. Warning window shoppers to stay away, he added, quote, "No person applying either from idle curiosity or a view to making improper discoveries, whatever that means, can possibly be attended to," unquote. Not long after, he announced that business required his attention in England and bowed out of Dublin with what little dignity remained him. Tussaud never saw his miserly ass again. The wax modeler's dealings with Philip Stahl instilled in her a fierce independence. Never again would she place herself at the mercy of another entrepreneur. She even declined to team up with Monsieur Charles, the family friend and open-handed ventriloquist who had helped her out in Edinburgh. She voiced her feelings in no uncertain terms, quote, "Once I have got away from Philip Stahl, I don't want any more joint ventures," unquote. Tussaud's partnership with Philip Stahl dissolved alongside another relationship in her life, that with Francois. As we discussed last time, Marie was one half of a topsy-turvy marriage. In a perfect inversion of contemporary gender roles, the wife in this union acted as main provider, while the husband depended overwhelmingly on her support. We have access to only one side of the communication between Marie and Francois. Her letters have come down to us, but his have not. Based on her replies to his messages, however, we can infer that Francois was feeling the financial pain of living without her in Paris, and money quite likely lay at the heart of their marital strife. The disintegration took place over the course of about a year. Things seemed more or less copacetic between the Tussauds when Marie was getting ready to leave London. She and Joseph wept with joy to receive word from him, after all. Furthermore, she appears to have indulged a request for financial assistance. On her last day in the British capital, she visited the law offices of Mr. George Wright at 41 Duke Street, Manchester Square. There, she had legal documents prepared granting Francois full power of attorney along with the authority, quote, "to borrow what seems good and on the best terms he can, all the money he requires and to compel his said wife to join with him completely in paying the capital interest laid down in any transaction," unquote. Remember, Marie inherited assets from her guardian, Philippe Curtiu. By making this arrangement in London, she showed a willingness to share that inheritance with Francois, empowering him to do with it as he pleased. She was also prepared to place herself on the hook for any loans he took out. By the time Tussaud had reached Edinburgh, however, the tone of her letters had turned from joyful to reproachful. Angered by his prolonged silence, she complains in a missive dated May 26th, quote, "This is the 100th letter I have written to you without reply. Why have you not written? Remember that I am your wife and that you are the father of my children," unquote. Any delay in his replies likely came about due less to neglect and more to the political tensions between England and France. At any rate, Marie had certainly heard from him by June 9th, and in his most recent letter, he had evidently asked her to come back to Paris. It's uncertain whether love, money, or some other motivation underlay that wish, but Marie had not anticipated it. At once befuddled and indignant, she wrote back with a hard pass. Quote, "I am not ready to return yet and can't help being surprised that you suggested before my business is cleared up and when all the ports are closed," unquote. She continues, "I will not return without a well-filled purse." 6 or 7 months later, Marie no longer had any intention of returning. This change of heart coincided with her triumphant break from Philip Stahl. Marie's hard-won artistic independence, coupled with a growing confidence in her ability to thrive in England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, led her to realign her priorities. In a crushingly honest mic drop of a letter, she tells Francois, quote, "The day I finished with Monsieur Philip Stahl, my enterprise became more important to me than returning to you." She goes on, "I now work only for myself and my children." From this time forward, Tussaud never doubted what mattered most: the prosperity of her business and the security of her sons, Joseph and Francis. Francois was no longer part of the picture. In a sense, there was one last man in Tussaud's life from whom she needed to separate herself. Unlike Philip Stahl and Francois, this one had never dragged her down, but rather lifted her up, had never taken every last shilling he could, but rather given all he had to give. Philippe Curthieu. In England and Scotland, Tussaud had counted on the bankability of Curthieu's renown. For example, in Edinburgh, she advertised waxworks, quote, modeled from life by the great Curthieu of Paris, unquote. You might have noticed earlier that she mentions him by name in the title of that early catalog as well. Tussaud stayed in Ireland from 1804 to 1808, traveling from city to city, and by May 1808, she had stepped out of Curthieu's shadow. While exhibiting in Belfast, she promoted her collection under her name and her name alone. Quote, Madame Tussaud, artist of the grand European cabinet of figures modeled from life, unquote. Biographer Kate Berridge says it best. Tussaud had given birth to herself as a brand. In Scotland and Ireland, Tussaud continued to exhibit her gruesome relics of the French Revolution, as well as her likeness of Colonel Despard. During these years, however, she started to display these figures in a showroom set apart from the rest of her collection. The name of this chamber varied over time, but it usually went by the separate room or the adjoining room. This division served at least two purposes. First, it implicitly passed a moral judgment on the individuals depicted in the separate room. While, generally speaking, the great and the good took pride of place in the main exhibition, the scum of the earth were to be seen next door in the separate room. This split would become more pronounced as Tussaud added likenesses of one notorious murderer after another to this collection. Second, Tussaud could boost revenue by charging an additional fee for admission to the separate room. Of course, many customers were more than happy to fork over the surcharge. The creepiest elements of Tussaud's waxworks were some of the most popular. Early in the process of storyboarding this season, I foresaw a problem with this chapter in Tussaud's biography. We've just taken her up to 1808, but she would not add a brand new likeness to the separate room until 1828. For the second half of this episode, we're leaping into the future to talk about the homicide that finally moved Tussaud to beef up the separate room. The homicide that altered the course of her career. Next episode, rather than moving forward from 1828, we'll turn back the clock and pick up with Tussaud circa 1810. For now, after a quick break, we'll hear the harrowing tale of William Corder and Maria Martin. Depending on whom you asked, William Corder led a respectable life before becoming the arch-villain of 1828. Born in 1803, he came from a well-to-do farming family who made their home in the village of Polstead, Suffolk, in the east of England. For 5 years of his boyhood, Corder attended a jacket-and-tie boarding school in Hadley, a market town in Suffolk, during which time he excelled as a student. As he matured, Corder became the picture of a handsome gentleman scholar, freckled and fresh-faced, sinewy if smallish at 5'4". Because of extreme short-sightedness, he wore a pair of eyeglasses that gave him a studious look. On a side note, despite his visual impairment, Corder was a crack marksman and had ample practice with a pistol. When he went to trial, numerous character witnesses testified to his kind-heartedness and general amiability. Others pointed out that he eschewed such vices as excessive drink and overspending. Indeed, Corder was mostly known to part with his money on account of a sweetheart. Yet still others were more critical in their assessment of Corder's character. Some complained of his haughty standoffishness, others of his propensity for gossip. Most disturbing were anecdotes about his dishonesty. This trait may have inspired one of Corder's sobriquets. Many called him by the familiar Bill, yet others nicknamed him Foxy, perhaps suggesting wiliness. On one occasion, Corder's father sold a litter of pigs to another Polstead farmer named Badham. After this sale, Corder rounded up several hogs from the family farm and offered them to Badham at a similar price, passing the livestock off as his own. Following this transaction, Corder's father discovered these missing swine in Badham's possession and accused his neighbor of stealing them. Badham vehemently denied this allegation, since he had made the purchase in good faith. An ugly dispute ensued, but in the end, Corder was exposed as the culprit. This was not the only porcine heist on his record. Shortly before the murder of Maria Martin, Corder fell in with Samuel Smith, alias Cooper, an ex-convict who had twice served time for stealing pigs. One night, the two snuck over to a neighboring village and filched a swine, later slaughtered by Corder. Asked about his partner in crime, Smith reportedly opined, "I'll be damned if he will not be hung some of these days." Time would prove him right. While Corder hailed from relative privilege, Maria Martin sprang from humbler stock. Born in 1801, she was the daughter of a scrappy Polstead mole catcher, Thomas, and his first wife, Gracie. As a girl, Maria went to live with the family of a clergyman in Lambe, Suffolk. There, she tended to the little ones in the nursery and furthermore received an education. Endowed with a keen intellect, Maria learned to read and write, setting her apart from many working-class girls in the country. When she lost her mother at the age of 9, however, she had no choice but to move back to the family cottage in Polstead, providing emotional support for her father and caring for her younger siblings. In the unlooked-for and draining role of preteen matriarch, Martin made an effort to continue her schooling with limited success. According to James Curtis, author of a contemporary book about the Red Barn murder, quote, "Having been blessed with a very retentive memory and her mind deeply imbued with a desire to acquire useful knowledge, there is every reason to believe that, if she had received proper tuition, she would have made an accomplished woman," unquote. Martin grew into a beautiful young woman, and it comes as no surprise that she attracted multiple suitors. At the age of 17, she entered into a romantic relationship with Thomas Corder, William's older brother. Probably because he belonged to a higher social class than Martin, Thomas insisted that they court on the sly. When Martin fell pregnant and then gave birth, Thomas grew distant, refusing to provide support for the child. Tragically, the baby died in infancy. Not long after, Martin was with child again, this time by the upper-middle class Peter Matthews. Like Thomas Corder, Matthews split once the baby arrived. Unlike Martin's first lover, however, he agreed to pay a monthly maintenance fee. This income proved vital as this child survived. He was christened Thomas Henry. As time wore on, Martin felt mounting pressure to marry. She had carried the children of two separate men, neither of whom proposed. Now, she had a toddler to care for and scant means to do so without a breadwinner. By the standards of the period, however, Martin would not have made the most desirable wife. As a mole catcher's daughter, she could offer little in the way of assets, and as a so-called fallen woman, she carried a potent and permanent stigma that would tarnish her household's reputation. So it was that Maria met William in or around September 1826. In what must have seemed an ominous reenactment of her relationship with Thomas, the older Corder brother, William insisted that they court in secret. Passions flared, and Martin was soon expecting a third child. Based on past experience, she had every reason to fear abandonment. Yet far from withdrawing, Corder leaned in, taking responsibility for the pregnancy and visiting the Martins' cottage on a regular basis. Maria's stepmother, Anne, disapproved of this foxy, perhaps aware of his deceitful habits, but Maria seems to have loved him. His concern for her welfare as she prepared to give birth for a third time may have reassured her that he cared too, nourishing a hope that he would make her his wife. The economic advantages of wedding Corder would not have been lost on her. In the span of 18 months, William's father and older brothers had passed away, leaving him as the proprietor of the lucrative family farm. The relationship unraveled in 2 short months. Martin brought the baby to term, but the quote-unquote sickly infant would not live more than a month. With their illegitimate offspring ineligible for Christian burial, Maria and William probably buried their child in the fields outside the nearby village of Sudbury. Then, on May 18th, 1827, soon after the death of their baby, Corder showed up at the Martins' cottage unannounced, ready at last to marry Maria, though not under circumstances she could have foreseen. In the presence of Martin's stepmother, Corder proposed that he and his paramour run away to Ipswich. There, they would tie the knot. They had to act fast and with the utmost discretion, Corder maintained, falsely claiming that parish constables were seeking Maria's arrest on account of her illegitimate children. To avoid detection, she would have to dress as a man, removing her disguise at a predetermined location. the old red barn on Barnfield Hill, about a half mile from the Martin residence. One imagines that Maria experienced the prospect of this drag show elopement as alarming, exhilarating, and even absurd. At any rate, she consented to Corder's scheme, saying her farewells and setting out from the cottage in the guise of a man. Her family never saw her alive again. But they did see Corder over the next few months. He took up residence outside Polstead shortly after Martin's disappearance, but still came home from time to time. Asked what on earth had become of Maria, Corder assured her family that he had married her in Ipswich as planned. His Polstead visits became increasingly infrequent until they ceased altogether, after which he communicated with the Martins by post. Now, he claimed, he and Mrs. Corder were living in blissful matrimony on the conveniently isolated Isle of Wight in the English Channel. When Martin's relatives demanded to know why Maria had not written to them herself, Corder unfailingly came up with an excuse. She had fallen ill or injured her writing hand. He also insisted that she had written to them, but the letter had gotten lost. These evasions kept up until about April 1828. Almost 12 months after Maria's vanishing. There are differing accounts of what precisely led to the discovery of the crime. Newspaper stories, as well as sermons about the Polstead bloodshed, repeated the more wondrous version over and over again. Maria's stepmother, Anne, supposedly saw her stepdaughter in a series of three dreams on as many consecutive nights, dead and buried inside the Red Barn. Driven by these revelatory visions, she prevailed on her husband to search the barn for traces of Maria. Surprisingly, perhaps, the story of Anne's nocturnal clairvoyance was submitted as evidence at Maria's inquest. However, as Judith Flanders notes in her indispensable study of the 19th century obsession with true crime, The Invention of Murder, no mention of Anne's dreadful dreams was made at Corder's trial. Instead, witnesses proffered a more prosaic explanation as to how the murder came to light. As worry over Maria's continued silence grew, a neighbor recalled that Corder had asked to borrow a spade on the day of her supposed departure for Ipswich. Another local remembered seeing the youth head toward the Red Barn with a pickaxe in hand. Whatever prompted him to take action, on April 19, 1828, Thomas went to the Red Barn equipped with a mole spike. Driving the sharp instrument into the earth inside a grain storage bin, he later testified with forensic matter-of-factness that he, quote, brought up something black, which I smelt and thought it was like decayed flesh, unquote. His olfactory nerve had not misled him. He unearthed the badly decomposed body of Maria Martin, buried in a sack. Her killer had shot her in the eye and stabbed her twice, once in the ribs and once in the heart. Furthermore, a postmortem noted, her attacker had pulled a green handkerchief, quote, so tight upon the neck as to have produced death by strangulation, unquote. It was impossible to determine which of these injuries killed the victim. An inquest was held, and Maria's sister, also named Anne, identified the body. Despite the advanced state of decomposition, she recognized the color and texture of her hair, that cyst on her face, the gap in her teeth. And then there was the green handkerchief, recovered from the crime scene. Anne knew this accessory on sight. It belonged to William Corder. Police had their prime suspect, and they made short work of tracking him down. He had left Polstead for London, it turned out, and you never would have taken him for a murdering bastard based on the life he was leading there. For starters, he had taken over as the co-owner of a girls' school, a respectable enough profession. On top of that, he had done what he promised to do with Maria Martin. He married. Indeed, he met his wife by placing an advertisement in the Lonely Hearts column of the Morning Herald and the Sunday Times. It reads, quote, a private gentleman, aged 24, entirely independent, whose disposition is not to be exceeded to any female of respectability, and willing to confide her future happiness in one every way qualified to render the marriage state desirable, as the advertiser is in affluence. In other words, he's rich. Should this meet the eye of any agreeable lady who feels desirous of meeting with a sociable, tender, kind, and sympathizing companion, they will find this advertisement worthy of notice, unquote. This tenderest, kindest, and most sympathizing gentleman bachelor received more than 40 responses to his ad in the Herald, combined with another 40 from the Sunday Times. Police arrested him more or less at the breakfast table in the company of his astonished wife. Next, he would go to trial. The Red Barn murder excited intense public interest. It had all the makings of a titillating melodrama. A lying villain, a largely sympathetic, cross-dressing heroine, illicit sex, a supposed elopement, a cold-blooded murder, and a discovery of the body by supernatural means. That the whole horrid affair had played out against the unspeakably bucolic backdrop of Polstead also captured the popular imagination. Before we discuss the many ways in which Britons indulged their curiosity about the Red Barn murder, I want to introduce a core concept of this season: true crime culture. Today, the true crime genre is a pillar of popular entertainment, encompassing multiple media. To give a few examples, we read newspapers, watch Netflix miniseries, and of course, listen to podcasts about sensational crimes, especially murder. Because the genre has become so popular on streaming platforms and other mass media, the craze for true crime can seem like a decidedly modern phenomenon. But if there's one thing I want you to take away from this season of The Art of Crime, it's this. People relished tales of true crime long before the 21st or even the 20th century. Britons were certainly gobbling them down in the 1820s, and you can rest assured they were before then too. In the early 19th century, various cultural institutions, newspapers, playhouses, and wax museums quickly realized the widespread appeal of true crime and exploited it for profit. Taken together, the staggering output of plays, songs, books, and so forth make up what I call true crime culture. In the 19th century, much like today, true crime culture cut across multiple media. A survey of the Red Barn murder mania will show you what I mean. Maybe quickest to cash in on the Polstead tragedy were the newspapers. Back then, journalistic standards were not what they are now. Even at the most reputable publications, newspapermen played fast and loose with the truth, especially if it allowed them to craft a narrative that would resonate with readers and thus boost sales. In The Invention of Murder, Judith Flanders examines how journalists covering the Red Barn murder airbrushed details about the key players to enhance the story. To begin with, they transformed Quarter, a well-to-do tenant farmer, into a filthy rich squire, a stock villain in contemporary stage plays. Condemnations of his character were commonplace, as were baseless accusations of further crimes. For example, the Times vilified him as, quote, unfeeling and wretched, unquote, falsely suggesting that he had tried to murder Martin's second child. Other periodicals ran with this unsubstantiated claim and cooked up a scheme in which Quarter had attempted to kill the toddler with a poisoned fig. At the same time, reporters downplayed Martin's illegitimate children, which otherwise would have damaged her reputation. According to the Times, even though, quote, her conduct cannot be justified, much might be said in palliation, unquote. In the end, the story of the Red Barn murder came to resemble the kind of black and white narratives that were characteristic of 19th century stage melodrama, in which pure villainy preyed on pure innocence. Those who could not afford newspapers, still relatively expensive at this time, might have turned to broadsides for up-to-date details about a horrible murder. Broadsides dated back to the 16th century, but technological advances had recently made it much easier and cheaper to produce them. Your typical broadside was a single, unfolded sheet of paper printed on one side. You could buy one on the street for a penny or less, or you could peruse one without paying for it at a pub. Much as modern sports bars mount TVs on the walls and screen football and soccer matches today, publicans back then would pin up broadsides for customers to enjoy as they downed their drinks. When a headline-grabbing homicide captivated the public, publishers released a series of broadsides, one for each major break in the case: the discovery of a body, the detainment of a suspect, the ensuing courtroom drama, all of which came to a profitable climax with an issue about the execution. In addition to a brief essay that was not unlike a news article, murder broadsides might feature relevant poems, ballads, and engravings. A broadside published about the Red Barn murder, viewable on the Art of Crime website, boasted no fewer than 5 engravings related to the case. One on the bottom left depicts the first time Martin set eye on the Red Barn, a nighttime scene, with Quarter pointing toward the building, perched at the top of a grassy hillock in the background, dark and foreboding beneath the moon overhead. Another on the bottom right illustrates Martin's fatal visit to the barn, this time bathed in the light of day, nestled among the fields of the countryside. True crime culture extended well beyond the realm of print media. Consider the Peep Show. Originating in the 15th century, peep shows made use of large wooden boxes with peepholes on one side. Paying customers peered through these apertures to gawk at images projected, painted, or otherwise displayed on the other end of the container. When depictions of a blood-curdling murder weren't on view, common subject matter included pictures of exotic animals, faraway places, courtly masks, and of course, pornography. Wandering entertainers set up peep shows at fairs or on street corners, charging a small fee for a look inside. As an adult, Lord George Sanger became proprietor of the largest circus in 19th century Europe, but as a boy, he toured fairgrounds with his father's peep show. In their apparatus, images were somehow raised and lowered by strings illuminated by candlelight after nightfall. Writing in 1910, Sanger recalls that his family business participated in the Red Barn murder mania. Sanger beckoned potential customers, "Walk up and see the only correct views of the terrible murder of Maria Martin. They are historically accurate and true to life. See how the ghost of Maria appeared to her mother on three successive nights at her bedside." Apart from Martin's homicide and her spectral homecoming, Corder's arrest figured prominently. "Observe the horrified faces," Sanger exclaimed as patrons squinted through peepholes. "And note also, these pictures are so true to life that even the saucepan is shown upon the fire and the minute glass upon the table timing the boiling of the eggs." Perhaps no institution turned a greater profit than the theaters. Dramatizations of the Red Barn murder played out in all manner of venues, from puppet booths to illegal, unlicensed playhouses known as penny gaffs. In May 1828, less than a month after the discovery of Martin's body, fairgoers were taking in dramatic reenactments of the murder in Stoke-by-Nayland, another village in Suffolk. In July, residents of and visitors to Polstead were treated to not one, but two separate theatrical representations of the late murder of Maria Martin, both at the Cherry Fair. The more graphic of these horror shows included a scene inside the Red Barn, quote, "where the mutilated body was seen lying on the floor, surrounded by the coroner and the gentlemen of the jury as they appeared after the fatal discovery," unquote. Because of its ties to the homicide, the Red Barn itself became an object of morbid fascination. Countless sightseers engaged in what you might call murder tourism, making day trips to visit the crime scene. Staffordshire potters sculpted models of the Red Barn, priced for sale to the middle classes. One ceramic replica is bright red, complete with a golden thatched roof, along with some chickens and a pig in the front yard. Meanwhile, a figure of Corder stands before the open doorway, beckoning to Martin, who is off to one side. With time, you could even own a piece of the barn. Not unlike the Bastille in 1789, the edifice was torn down, after which merchants sold the detritus as toothpicks, tobacco stoppers, and even snuff boxes. We'll hear how this surge of true crime culture impacted the trial and execution of Corder after a quick break. Ceramic decorations and marionette plays might sound harmless, but the nationwide murder festival raised concerns about whether Corder could receive a fair trial. Newspaper, broadside, peep show, melodrama, the medium did not matter. Time and again, Corder's culpability was taken for granted, so by the time he went to trial in early August 1828, much of the public considered him guilty until proven innocent. The defendant's attorney seized on this problem, asking of one witness, a churchwarden, quote, "Are there not exhibitions going round the neighborhood representing Corder as the murderer, and you've not interfered to prevent them? Is there not a camera obscura near this very hall at this moment exhibiting him as the murderer?" Unquote. In this context, the term camera obscura probably refers to a peep show. The clergyman responded, "There is a camera obscura, I believe, about the streets, but I do not know the nature of the exhibition. Neither am I aware that I have any power to prevent them in my own parish, much less in this town." Hardly a win for the defense. The possibility of a tainted jury pool might have caused more of an uproar if Corder had not obviously committed the crime. The evidence against him was overwhelming. Martin was last seen in his company. His green handkerchief was found at the crime scene. Police discovered a handbag belonging to Martin in his study. In the same room, he kept a pair of pistols along with a sword. Corder was later shown to have had this blade sharpened right before the killing. And let's not forget, he lied to the Martins for months about living on the Isle of Wight with Maria, who in fact was dead and buried in a barn. Nothing sketchy about that. Corder's attempts to defend himself were pitiful. He told the court that Martin had planned to flee Polstead in an effort to conceal another illegitimate pregnancy, a falsehood that bore less than a second of scrutiny. She had already had three children out of wedlock, so why would a fourth suddenly send her running for the hills? After this assertion, Corder spoke of some nebulous relationship between Martin and an unnamed man from London. When she met him, that is, Corder, at the Red Barn on the day of her death, quote, "She flew into a passion, upbraided me with not having so much regard for her as the gentleman before alluded to," unquote. Then she shot herself dead. Panicking that others would suspect him of murdering her, he buried the body without reporting the suicide. To nobody's surprise, Corder was convicted and sentenced to death. On August 11th, a large crowd assembled to watch him hang at Bury St. Edmunds Jail. The exact number of spectators is unknown, but estimates range from 7 to 20,000. According to one broadside, the condemned man was, quote, "so weak as to be unable to stand without support, and he looked somewhat wildly around," unquote, as the hangman adjusted the noose. Corder died a prolonged and agonizing death. He survived the initial fall from the scaffold, the drop having failed to break his neck. In the words of one witness, the executioner performed the, quote, "disgusting but necessary task of suspending his own weight around the body of the prisoner to accelerate his death," unquote. Despite this, quote unquote, humane measure, Corder kicked and twitched for 8 minutes until finally falling still. Ever prepared to make some fast cash, the hangman is reported to have sold segments of the cord that strangled Corder at a guinea an inch. The spectator sport of public execution gave way to a more scientific, if at times pseudo-scientific, line of inquiry: the anatomy of a murderer. The criminal's corpse was transported from the gallows to the Shire Hall, where a surgeon laid out his body and removed the skin from his upper torso, exposing the bones and muscle tissue beneath. This macabre anatomical display was open to the public. Over the next 24 hours or so, thousands of sightseers came to view it. The next day, the cadaver was transferred to the county hospital, where it underwent public humiliation in the name of scientific instruction. Specialists in galvanism wired it up to a battery and administered shocks, showing how muscles spasmed with electricity. Phrenologists also weighed in on the specimen. The junk science of phrenology held that you could make inferences about human behavior based on the shape and texture of the skull. Presumably, the bumps and craters of Corder's cranium revealed his inherent capacity to kill. Afterward, anatomists separated skin from bone entirely and exhibited the killer's skeleton in the Suffolk General Hospital. Most gruesomely of all, perhaps, one medical professional tanned a quantity of the leftover skin, which he planned to use as binding for a book about Corder's life and trial. Corder was dead, but the story of his despicable crime was kept alive for decades. Some version of it held the English stage for much, maybe most, of the rest of the 1800s, not to mention the beginning of the 20th century. As they mounted and remounted productions about the Red Barn slaying, playmakers kept things fresh with new gimmicks. Some made use of special effects. For instance, one script concludes with a veritable phantasmagoria. In the final scene, Corder sits in his prison cell on the eve of his execution. The spirit of Maria Martin appears without warning, awash in the eldritch glow of blue fire, her visitation accompanied by a ghostly melody. Others deployed special guest casting. In the early 1860s, one production featured James Lee, the very same policeman who arrested Corder in London. 76 years old at the time of this performance, Lee played himself and reenacted the detainment. The Red Barn murder also proved influential in music. It was common practice for balladeers to write and sing songs about real-life homicides. In 1908, English folk singer Joseph Taylor sang a passage from a ballad about Maria Martin to Percy Grainger, who recorded the performance using a wax cylinder.
Me, I feel as far and as sure as I have lied. I will take you to Ipswich Town and we'll make you my wife. It's the light when Tom and Betsy's son is picked up on this day. He went on to the red barn and nearly took the grave.
What you're hearing right now is a snippet of that recording, and if you want to hear more, there's a link on the Art of Crime website. As it happens, I found out about another musical allusion to the Red Barn murder quite by accident while working on this episode. I listen to music when I research and write, and I was going through the discography of experimental blues and jazz singer Tom Waits. He's a phenomenal lyricist with a penchant for the dark and sordid, and he sounds like he started smoking a pack a day in the womb and grew up in a coal mine. Depending on your tastes, that description might not sound too appealing, but I dig his music and would highly recommend it. His most popular album is Rain Dogs, and it's probably my favorite. Anyway, I was writing this episode and listening to Waits' 1992 record, Bone Machine, which I had never heard before, when the opening line of a song made my jaw drop. There was a murder in the Red Barn, a murder in the Red Barn. I looked at my phone and realized that I was listening to a song entitled Murder in the Red Barn. Its lyrics are cryptic as all get out, but appear not to make any direct reference to the historical crime. Rather than croon or croak about the murder of Maria Martin, Waits calls attention to the everyday violence of agricultural labor with this haunting line. Because there's nothing strange about an axe with bloodstains in a barn. There's always some killing you gotta do around the farm. Given the powerful and what would prove enduring interest in the Red Barn murder, it's no wonder Tussaud found a way to make a buck on it. She introduced an effigy of Corder in the separate room shortly after his hanging. According to Pauline Chapman, she was unable to attend either his trial or execution, so she could not make sketches for her model from life. Fortunately for her, however, there were other reliable sources to work from. At least two artists, Mizzonti of Cambridge and a certain Mr. Child, did have a chance to visit Shire Hall when the killer's cold body was laid out on a slab, and one or both took death masks of Corder. Fashioning her model with the help of Corder's death mask would allow Tussaud to stress the accuracy of her effigy, even though she had never seen the perpetrator in the flesh. Probably truer to life than the average broadside engraving, and certainly more faithful than an actor playing the killer on stage, Tussaud's effigy played a part in fixing Corder's image in the public consciousness. The unveiling of Corder's likeness marked a watershed in Tussaud's career. Since the outbreak of the French Revolution, she had only depicted crimes and criminals that were political in nature. In striking contrast, neither William Corder nor the murder of Maria Martin bore any connection to the realm of politics. This exception became the norm, and her sculpture of Corder remained on display for many years. Next episode, we crisscross the United Kingdom with Tussaud and her burgeoning family business. Along the way, we'll head back to Edinburgh, where a killing spree garnered national attention and motivated another new addition to the separate room less than 1 year after the Red Barn murder. You've been listening to The Art of Crime, created, written, and narrated by yours truly, Gavin Whitehead. Liam Bellman-Sharp edited sound and composed the score. Last but not least, a thousand thanks to research and production assistant Ken Symphonies. The Art of Crime is part of the Airwave Media Network. To find out more about their excellent programming, visit www.airwavemedia.com. If you like what you heard on The Art of Crime, please tell the world, by which I mean everyone you know, plus the occasional stranger. Also, if you can, take a moment to rate and review the podcast. It goes a long way in helping others find out about the show. Finally, all throughout history, artists have relied on the support of patrons to make their work. The same holds true for podcasters making shows about historical artists, so please consider making a donation at www.patreon.com/artofcrimepodcast. Every bit counts and is massively appreciated. As a reminder, be sure to check out the Art of Crime website at www.artofcrimepodcast.com. It features all kinds of images relevant to the show, including maps, drawings, paintings, photographs, sheet music, and more. You can also follow us on Facebook at Art of Crime Podcast, Instagram at Art of Crime Podcast, and Twitter at Art of Crime Pod. If you have questions, comments, or feedback, please don't hesitate to drop me a line at artofcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time.